May it please the Court. Your Honors, the District Court committed plain reversible error by failing to grant Mr. Yescas his right to allocution before sentence was imposed. Rule 32 in this Court's case law requires that the Court inform a defendant of the right to allocute, and more pertinent here, it requires that the defendant be given an opportunity to personally speak. Here, the Court violated Mr. Yescas' right to allocution by not providing him with an opportunity to speak. The lawyer for Mr. Yescas said he would argue first, and after he argued, the government and the lawyer for Mr. Yescas got engaged in a dispute about Mr. Yescas' prior Kansas conviction. At that point, the Court cut off discussion by saying, "Gentlemen, I've heard enough and I've read enough where I think I'm ready to sentence." The Court asked counsel a few more questions and said, "I'm done." Therefore, the Court never provided Mr. Yescas with the opportunity to allocute. This Court has asked whether its decision in Walker is applicable.
Let me go back to that colloquy, because I think Judge Steig, to be precise, because I think the language is helpful. The Court says, as you have witnessed earlier, you have a right to speak about your sentence, and your lawyer has a right to speak about your sentence, and the government's lawyer has a right to speak. Now, then he says, as between you and Mr. Alfaro, who shall go first? And the response comes back with the defense lawyer, of course, says, I can go first, Your Honor. Okay, that's fine. And then they go forward with this discussion. So we start this difficulty of the missing allocution with the judge acknowledging it need to speak directly to the defendant and then inviting a response. In that circumstance, what at some point is there not some obligation on the part of a defendant who gets lost in the shuffle? Or is it that you simply have, no matter what else has been said, the judge has got to speak directly to the defendant?
Well, the judge, in Walker, the judge didn't cut off conversation. In this case, the judge cut off conversation. I guess I would refer the Court to the Court's decision in Sparrow, which I don't discuss in my brief, but I do quote. And in Sparrow, and it's directly, it's probably the most analogous case here. In Sparrow, the Court informs the multiple defendants that they have the right to speak. And then when one of the defendants speaks, the Court says, well, asks for a certain sentence. The Court makes a caustic comment and says, well, I'm not going to let some criminal tell me what sort of sentence to impose. And Sparrow never speaks. And this Court held that the Court's comment to the other co-defendant communicated to Sparrow that the Court wasn't going to listen, and so the Court found a violation of the right to allocution. The Court wasn't caustic here, but it's directly analogous. Here the Court says, you have the right to speak. The lawyers go first, and then the Court says, whoa, I've heard enough, I've read enough, I'm ready to sentence. So just like in Sparrow, the Court's comment cuts off conversation and communicates that's the end.
But is that, in context, really what happens? The lawyer says the client doesn't want to talk about the family matter. And then the lawyer says at the end, that's what we have. Like he's done, that's what we have. And then after the judge cuts off the argument between the government lawyer and the defense lawyer, they go on for longer. So it's not that he's cut it off and says, I don't want to hear another word out of anybody. The fact that he says that's what we have and the client doesn't want to talk, doesn't that in fact lead the judge into thinking that the client is not going to go second after all, that he's already said the client's position? And in fact, he does several times say, my client said this and this is the situation. He's explaining the situation.
That's not good enough. He has to personally make it unequivocally and expressly clear. That's what this Court's case law says, and the same is true in Sparrow. I mean, I don't see how you can infer. The lawyer says that's what we have, so there's no more right to allocution. There's no more opportunity to talk, where the lawyer said, I'll go first, meaning.
But don't you have to have some situation where the lawyer said, now my client would like to talk, and then the judge saying, no, I've heard enough. Don't you need once he's already invited the allocution?
No.
Don't you need a statement from the lawyer at that point?
That's not this court's holding in Sparrow, and that's not what happened in Sparrow. And the court repeatedly has said that silence during allocution isn't waiver. I mean, even in Reyna, which went en banc, the government took the abandonment position before the panel, and the panel rejected it. And the court went on to Reyna to talk about plain error. I mean, Sparrow's directly on point. Same thing, I mean, Lee is not so much on point, but
how
still
is Sparrow directly on point where he says, I'm not going to hear from the defendant? The judge explicitly rejects hearing from the defendant in that case and not in this case.
No,
in fact,
he didn't say, I'm not going to hear from that defendant. He said,
I've heard enough. I'm not going to let him tell me what to do.
No. He said that to the co-defendant.
Yeah.
He didn't say it to the defendant. And yet this court said, well, what does it mean when a judge says, gentlemen, I've heard enough. I've read enough. I'm ready to sentence. What do you say if you're a defendant with a third-grade education? The guy didn't even understand the sentence. You're going to infer that he somehow understood that when the
there was another comment that we're skipping over here, I think, and that after the defendant and the defense counsel elected for the counsel to go first on behalf of the defendant, after the defense counsel spoke, the district court said that he would speak directly to the defendant. He said that he would speak to the defendant after it addressed the district attorney. Then he said, does the United States, I'm quoting, care to respond before I talk to the defendant? So he came back to, after this initial exchange, still on the track, obviously, of allocution. And then at that point, the court turns to the government, and the government speaks, and then that's when it drops off. And
that's when he says, I'm done. That's it. I'm ready to sentence. I've heard enough. I've read enough. I'm not. What does that mean? He did not unequivocally and expressly give the defendant the opportunity to allocute. Sparrow's on point. If you don't give you can tell the person you have the opportunity to allocute and talk to me, but if you don't give him the opportunity, as this court said in many cases, it's merely formalistic and isn't sufficient. And this court has said that over and over in the cases in my brief. And
Are you suggesting that the district court has to go back and either renew his invitation or else ask the defendant why he doesn't wish to say anything?
I think it depends on the facts. I think in this case, if he had merely said, Mr. Yeskus, it's now your turn, there are cases that this court has handed down that said that's not sufficient to just say it's your turn. But I would say if he said, now it's your turn, combined with the initial statement of you have the right, but I think the court has to do something and provide the opportunity. You can't just say, you have the right, Mr. Yeskus, you have the right to tell me anything you want. I'm going to hear from the attorneys first and let the attorneys talk and say, okay, now I've heard enough, I've read enough, I'm going to sentence. So, yes, the court has to come back and provide the opportunity. Whether it has to be some magic words or not, I'm not saying that, but it has to inform the defendant of the right to allocute and it has to provide the opportunity and not merely give some formalistic statement that you have the opportunity, and that didn't happen here.
Do you think the defense counsel has any responsibility at all to step up and say, Your Honor, you forgot here, you know, you said you were going to give him an opportunity to allocute. Yes, we've seen all these others, and I said we were done, but we're really not done until he allocutes, and you said you were going to let him.
Well, I mean, the responsibility and what the law is, yes, of course defense counsel has a responsibility to protect his client's rights, and that's why the penalty is that we're under the plain error standard. I mean, it's a forfeiture, not a waiver. So because defense counsel didn't ask for the opportunity for his client to speak, at the end of the hearing when the judge said, whoa, I'm done, then we're under the plain error standard.
And the Supreme Court said, in speaking to this allocution question under the rule, it said in the language, exact language, hereafter trial judges should leave no room for doubt that the defendant has been issued, but has been issued a personal invitation to speak prior to sentencing. Now, I guess we ask the question of whether or not trial judges effectively invited them to speak, as he said, well, I'm going to do this, and you know, we're going to take that up next kind of thing, and it just gets dropped.
Well, I mean, like Eshigol and Barroetta says, the court has to permit the defendant to speak. I believe Rule 32 not only says he has to inform the defendant, but I think has to allow him to speak or some similar language. So, I mean, clearly the judge couldn't get up here and said, you have the right to speak to me. I now impose sentence of 51 months in jail. We're done. That wouldn't cut it, right? So there has to be an opportunity. You can't just say you have the right and then ignore it.
Well, there was an opportunity, and the lawyer took the opportunity instead.
No,
he could have talked right then. He said, you and your lawyer can talk now, and the lawyer chose to speak.
He said, who will go first? He said, I'll go first. There's nothing wrong with that. There are two
rights. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but that was an opportunity for him to go. There was an actual opportunity.
No, he asked who will go first, and the lawyer said, I'll go first. So he went first, and then the judge cut off the conversation. I mean, there are two rights under Rule 32 that the judge had to accord. One is for the lawyer to allocute in mitigation of sentence, and one is for the defendant. And the judge informed them, okay, I mean, I think implicitly informed them, there are two rights here. And you get to speak and you get to speak. Who's going first? And so the lawyer said, I'll go first. And then the judge cuts off the conversation. I mean, just because the lawyer fulfills his function under Rule 32 doesn't mean the court can then cut off conversation.
Well, do you concede that you're here under plain error?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then it's the first element of that, the judge could have given him a sentence that below the guidelines, right?
Correct.
So you're down to what do you do with the balance of the plain error argument?
Well, first, prejudice is presumed under the third prong because this court has said, as I say in my brief, that if the defendant requests a sentence below the guidelines, which this lawyer did, and the court doesn't give it, then prejudice is presumed. And then on the fourth prong, this court said in Reyna that the court will normally remand where prejudice is presumed. However, there is a limited class of cases in which it will not exercise its discretion. And here is where I probably say something surprising. I think that Magwood and the cases that follow Magwood are contrary to this court's en banc opinion, because to say that the court will ordinarily remand and only in a limited class of cases will not remand is different than the case law that comes from Magwood and following Magwood to say, we're not going to remand unless you tell me what you would have said. I mean, Magwood and the cases following Magwood flip the burden. The second thing I would say is that there has to be, the test under the fourth prong can't require the defendant to do something impossible in violation of due process, like go outside the record and get an affidavit from your client and show me what he would have had to say. So it's got to be something in the record that has to be there if you're going to apply that test, which I think is contrary to Reyna. So when you apply that test and you look at the district court's own comments, you see that there is something that Mr. Yeskus could have talked about. Number one, the district court said, I'm not going to go below the guidelines, but I am going to sentence him to the minimum sentence, number one, because his family's in Kansas and it's a magnet, and number two, because he has an alcohol problem and experimented with drugs. So just those two statements, disregarding the fact that the lawyer said that Mr. Yeskus did not want to talk about the personal family matter, show that there's something that he could have talked about. In addition, Mr. Yeskus could have talked about the severe medical problem that he had that was very debilitating, that caused the marshal to respond that he would get him help immediately. So, Your Honor, that is what I do with the third and fourth prongs of the plain error test.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Socolow. You've saved some time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Ms. Wilson?
May it please the court. The district court did not plainly err by failing to grant Mr. Romero-Yescas the opportunity to allocate. Under Rule 32, the rule is satisfied where the defendant is given an opportunity to allocute. In the instant case, there's no doubt that the court personally addressed the defendant and invited him to speak, as Judge Higginbotham pointed out.
Well, the requirement is that he, the defendant, be extended a personal invitation to speak. That's the language of the Supreme Court.
Correct. I was just paraphrasing. But in this case, what we had initially was the district court specifically asked Mr. Yescas whether he had gone over the PSR with his attorney, and he responded yes. And the next series of questions were along the lines of whether or not Romero or his counsel would go first. So clearly he's still speaking, to Mr. Romero. And as the court has pointed out, Mr. Romero's counsel said that he would go first. And as I recall, the judge says something like, okay, and there's something in the way that the transcript is read to suggest that perhaps the judge even looked at Mr. Yescas, because on page 48, Mr. Yescas says, yes, that's fine. So in other words, the district court still has him engaged. And of course, at this point then, Mr. Yescas' counsel then just starts discussing why there should be a downward variance. And as Judge Elrod pointed out, that he concludes on page 50 by saying, that's what we have. Following that, there's the invitation to the government, in which the district court again mentions that he's going to speak to the defendant. However, under Washington, as well as Hernandez, which I need to 28J this court on, and Judge Smith was on the panel, where counsel has spoken, the judge is not, where 32 is satisfied by the district court giving a defendant a personal opportunity to speak on behalf of his sentence, and then his counsel speaks, the district court is not required to renew that invitation. And that makes sense. The reason is this court, as well as we, have seen numerous allocutions and transcripts of sentencing. Things often get heated or confusing or complex or whatnot. And to put the burden solely on the district court multiple times, number one, doesn't comport with Rule 32. Rule 32 only says that the invitation has to be made. It doesn't say it has to be made second time or third time. In other words, it doesn't have to be renewed.
But the judge never really, Judge Stagg never really invited him to speak. What happened each time is that he said, he did plainly lead everybody to believe that he's going to get to that.
That's correct, but I would disagree in the sense that I do believe that he extended that invitation to him to speak right off the bat, but that Mr. Yescas' counsel elected to go first. The specific language was, as you witnessed earlier, so obviously he had seen some people, other people be sentenced and presumably allocute. Then the court says, you have a right to speak about your sentence, and your lawyer has the right to speak about your sentence, and the government's lawyer has the right to speak, as between you and Mr. Alfaro, who shall go first. I think right then and there, Rule 32 was satisfied. And, of course, his counsel elected to go first. Now, the problem, you know, one of the things that this court has to bear in mind is, of course, Mr. Yescas was represented by able counsel. He was represented by an assistant federal public defender. He obviously has some duty.
There's the next line of that. The defendant, part of the response to that, the defendant individually apparently responds, that's fine, meaning that his lawyers speak first.
Correct.
No.
Correct. And I don't disagree with that. However, as several of us have mentioned already, his lawyer then says, that's what we have on page 50. And then there's all this exchange about the Kansas conviction. Now, at the very end, the judge does say he wants to go forward and sentence. But I think that the context of that, as Judge Elrod pointed out, is very different from those cases where the judge has cut the person off. For example, in Valtierra and others, where the judge just doesn't want to have anything to do with it. In this particular case, the lawyers were essentially offering nothing new. They were arguing about what the documentary evidence meant. And as Mr. Yeska's counsel said, I think it was on page 48, that his client did not want to discuss the facts surrounding that. So what we were what he was doing is, you're challenging the 16-level enhancement you're very unhappy with, but your client essentially has given you nothing to work with, and the door has been shut. So everybody's arguing about what this document meant or did not mean, and that's when the district court decided to go ahead and to sentence him. Now, the judge, post-sentencing, asked first of Mr. Yeska, do you understand? And secondly, he then asked them if there are any other questions. And there are cases out there that talk about how the judge could, you know, do it clean up or what have you, that sentence is temporarily suspended. I think there's some cases out of the First Circuit or whatnot. And I'm not saying that's exactly what occurred here, but it does, that when you take the whole thing in context, Yeska never attempts to talk. And let's assume that you do find error, and we're getting to the third and fourth prong.
He spoke up after he was sentenced.
I'm sorry, sir?
He spoke up after he was sentenced.
I think he made a declarative statement saying, wow, you know, that's a lot of time.
That's a lot of time, and how do I appeal? So
he said, I'd like to appeal, if I may, I think.
To me, the case is recognize the reality that you can't expect a defendant in this context to interrupt or to jump up and say, wait a minute, you forgot to get to me, before he's being sentenced. Now, after sentencing, you see this concern about hacking the judge off, interrupting him in his speech, and all those things, which are very powerful, are gone. And this guy's right on his feet after that point. But up until that point, he's waiting to see what happens.
But we don't have a pro se defendant. We have a defendant who is ably represented by counsel. And what we learn, if we get to the third and fourth prongs here...
But counsel can't do it for him. I mean, that's one of the difficulties of allocution, because the rule says, bypasses the lawyer. It says that you must individually address the defendant.
And of course, that's correct. What I'm talking about is pointing out that if his client wants to exercise that
tug on his lawyer's sleeve.
Right, that the lawyer needs to say, excuse me, but Mr. Yeska needs to allocute here. And Mr.
I agree with him.
Okay. In relation to the Sparrow case, as I recall that case, there were like 13 or 15 defendants or something, and the judge was going through all these series of allocutions and whatnot. And there was a very caustic exchange with one of the other defendants. And this case is very different from that. We have a judge who is very attentive, who wanted to do the right thing. We have a defendant, and this is what I was saying before, even if we get to the third and fourth prong, what we learn here is there's nothing different. He was sentenced at the bottom of the guidelines, presumably because the judge did listen to some of these Kansas arguments. While it was an aggravated burglary and aggravated assault, he wound up getting probation. It was his sister-in-law. But Mr. Yeska wanted to remain mum about that. His counsel was very clear about that, said more than once there was more to the story, but he had been instructed that, and maybe he didn't even know himself. But what we learn on appeal is nothing changes, because if you look at page 20 of the appellate brief, still nothing concrete is being offered. The type of detail that this court discussed, meaning in Avila and some of these other cases, because on page 20, what we have is that Mr. Yeska could have addressed the medical issue, which, by the way, is something that apparently arose during his incarceration. It had nothing to do with the actual sentence. Another comment that was made is, quote, he might have well chosen to discuss the facts of the Kansas conviction. Quote, could have enlightened the court about alcohol and drugs. You know, coulda, shoulda, woulda. Those are not the kind of concrete details that would have changed things. Mr. Yeska, it's very speculative. And so, arguably, you can reach the conclusion here that he wouldn't have done these things because he's not willing to say, I would have told the court, something along the lines that you see in some of this court's prior cases. There is the plain error burden here. There's also no evidence to suggest in this particular record, as you see in some of these other cases, where a defendant is attempting to allocute and he is shut down, or where the defendant is asked to allocute about something and it's clear he doesn't understand what's going on. This is much more simple. We have the judge extend the invitation, trying to fulfill his responsibilities or the court's responsibilities under Rule 32, The invitation is recognized, but the counsel decides to proceed instead. And think about it. If he's saying his client won't discuss the 16-level enhancement, which is the heart of this, I mean, the heart of the problem as they see it is the sentencing, because nobody's arguing, quarreling about the eight level, because there's, you know, he pled guilty and that's all fine. It's all about this 16-level bump. Well, if he's saying his client won't even discuss the facts, it doesn't change. And so I do think that as this court has recognized, in particular on the fourth prong, that these are factual specific inquiries. And what we have here is we don't have, even if this court finds error, and I don't think that it does exist, but even if the court does find it, this is one of these cases that doesn't require a remand and resentencing based on a thorough evaluation of the record and the comments or the lack of detail, excuse me, that's been provided on appeal. The district court also was clear that it was the proper sentence, saying something about the Kansas situation. And if the court, you know, the court could have obviously gone much higher on the guidelines. As I mentioned before, I think the 28J letter that Mr. Sokolow submitted on Valtierra is not controlling, because that was a situation where there were various interruptions. And the Lee case out of the Second Circuit, where there was the older woman who was accused of all these check forgeries, she was very hysterical and was trying to essentially relitigate, for lack of a better word, her guilt. And the court felt that that had been, the Rule 32 had been reduced to a mere formality. Whereas in this case, to sum up, I believe that the Rule 32 responsibility, the court fulfilled it. And under Washington and these other cases, there was no responsibility on the part of the judge to renew or re-extend the invitation. And unless the court has any questions, the government requests that this court affirm.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Mr. Sokolow, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Just a few points. I think the case law throughout the circuits will show that counsel's statement that a medical issue has nothing to do with the sentence is not correct. There are many sentences that take account, and the district court can take account of the defendant's conditions and medical condition. Second of all, I want to just reiterate what I said before. Under the fourth prong, aside from the fact that I think Magwood and the cases following it are contrary to Reyna, under the fourth prong, the court requires the defendant to show what he would have said to possibly change the sentence. Now, it cannot be something outside the record, because you are not allowed to go outside the record. So if this court is requiring me to go to Mr. Yeskus and get an affidavit, you're requiring me to do something I'm not allowed to do. So there has to be some test for what is in the record that doesn't require as much as going and getting an affidavit. And the question would be, what would that test look like? Well, the only thing you can look to is what the district judge said, what the attorney said, and if the defendant said anything, what the defendant said. And we have those things. We have the judge imposing the minimum sentence because of alcohol abuse, imposing the minimum sentence because the family's in Kansas and it's a magnet. So we have some things that Mr. Yeskus could personally talk about that are shown in the record. And if a defendant is going to be allowed to show anything, it's got to be that type of thing. It can't be go outside the record, get an affidavit, and then submit it, because you're not allowed to do that on appeal. So my point is that under the way the test of the fourth prong should be administered, there is enough in the record to show that there are topics that Mr. Yeskus could have talked about that could have swayed the district court. This case also, I'd just like to emphasize, is more, as I said in the brief, is more like Lister and Avila Cortez than it is like Magwood and Reyna. A motivating factor in Magwood and Reyna was that those defendants had the right to allocute and the opportunity to allocute in their original proceedings. Magwood and Reyna were supervised release proceedings, and that was important to this court. In Lister, this court said that the defendant barely got to say anything, and that's true here. before sentence is imposed, I think Mr. Yeskus said three things.
Let me be clear. What would he have said to the judge that would have made a difference at that point?
I think, number one, he could have talked about returning to his family in Kansas, and the judge saw that. What the judge says is, okay, I'm not going to go below the guidelines. We're going to impose the minimum sentence. And he says there's alcohol abuse here, there's experimentation with drugs, and his family is a virtual magnet in Kansas. So there clearly are things that the judge thought were important. And what I'm saying is that's evidence of what he could have talked about to sway the judge. And the government's brief and here, their position shows too much. Because they're saying, oh, you can look at the PSR, the judge heard from the lawyer, but if all that were true, there wouldn't be a right to allocution. As the Supreme Court said in Green, it's the defendant's halting eloquence that makes the difference. It's hearing from the defendant himself, not from the lawyer, not from the PSR, not from the government, but from the defendant himself. And that's why that the judge can look to the PSR or can look to other things doesn't matter under the Supreme Court's decision in Green. For all these reasons, Your Honor.
Why can't we look at the context in which he was given an initial opportunity, and maybe the judge should have renewed it more specifically, but say that this doesn't affect the fairness and integrity and public reputation, look at it in the big picture of the fourth prong, and say, where he's not cut off, and there's not really anything specific that he could say, but in this context, where he was given an initial, that the fourth prong is not satisfied, apart from, do you see what I'm saying? The big picture of the fourth prong.
Yeah, well, I think the fact that he wasn't given an opportunity is not under the fourth prong.
But the way that he was given an opportunity, at least initially, look at the totality of the circumstances and say this, where he was given an opportunity and maybe he should have renewed it and he didn't. How is the public integrity offended by this sentence?
Well, because I don't think that's the analysis in the first two prongs is, was the opportunity merely formalistic? And it was. So, and with regard to the fourth prong, I would say that there is evidence in the record that there are things that Mr. Yeskus could have spoke to the court about that would have swayed the court. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Sokolow. Your case is under submission. The last case for today, United States versus Hernandez.